Good evening, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, and we are coming to you live from the Hobby Center in downtown Houston, Texas. I like that energy. All right, so we have a big show planned for you this evening. We've got a 2020 Democratic primary draft. It's been a couple months since the last time we did one, and there are about half a dozen more candidates in the race since then. So we'll lay down some markers for who we think is most likely to win the Democratic nomination at this point. Also tonight, we're in a state that gave the country the Bushes. They helped shape the Republican Party across three decades. But today the party is a little bit different, so we'll debate what happened to the Republican Party of George W. Bush with a special guest from Houston. But before we get to any of that, let me introduce the fabulous folks sitting next to me. Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver, how's it going? Senior politics writer Claire Malone.
Thank you.
And managing editor Micah Cohen.
Next show, I want to go before Claire. I've had enough of this.
So let me also say that this is our last night in Texas, and we've had a really nice time, as you can see from the slide behind us. We got to play with some cattle, eat some tacos. And so thanks to all of you Texans for sharing your stay with us over the past week. It's been really great. And also thank you for coming tonight. You're the most important part of the show, so give yourselves a round of applause. We are going to get to our draft and the evolution of the Republican Party, but let's kick things off with one of our favorite questions. Does anyone know what that is? Good use of polling or bad use of polling? Yes, there we go. All right. Last week, CNN released a new poll showing that President Trump had reached an all-time high in approval for how he's handling the economy. 56% of Americans approved. And then various commentators cited that poll, saying that it could bode well for his re-election chances. So let's begin with this. Is approval of how Trump's handling the economy a helpful indicator for his re-election odds, Nate?
Not really. Not if you know his overall approval rating. That tends to be a lot more predictive of the president's re-election chance. I mean, if you think about it, Trump kind of gets a relatively high mark, actually a pretty high mark in a partisan epic to have 56% on the economy, lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. So people are able to overcome partisanship and say, yeah, I approve of Trump on the economy. But his overall numbers are still 43 or 42%, which means that all the extracurricular stuff, you might call it, tends to weigh him down quite a bit. And there are debates. I don't know how long we want to get in a debate tonight about, like, is the economy more predictive and do things kind of revert to a mean where, in the end, the economy is what matters the most? You know, I tend to think that given the fact that the economy has been good throughout his whole term, maybe especially good now or maybe not, there's been a few jitters in the stock market, that you have to explain why his approval rating is 43% and not 55% overall. And the answer is that the economy is important. It maybe explains 40% of why presidents win or lose re-elections, but the other 60% does not look as favorable for Trump.
Okay, so Micah and Claire, his approval rating is 43%. His approval on the economy is 56%. Who are those 13%, and are they the people who decide the 2020 election?
The key 13%. They tend to be, look, in 2016, and this is maybe where I'd push back on Nate a little bit. In 2016, we saw a kind of crucial group of people who didn't like Trump, who had an unfavorable view of Trump and Clinton, but who voted for Trump. And that kind of, that was what, like a 20%, a fifth of the electorate about. And Trump won that group. So I do think there is a chance that there's voters out there, the 13%, who like what Trump has done on the economy, don't approve of him overall, but depending on who Democrats nominate, could vote for him in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why I kind of balk at the economy being an indicator of whether or not Trump is going to be, you know, in a strong place for his reelection efforts is because that hasn't been the issue that people necessarily associate with him. I mean, he wants people to associate that with him, and he will talk and tweet about the economy, but I think the much more staying issue for him is immigration. Or, frankly, the other sort of ephemera problems that he has with the Mueller report and sort of the witch hunt vein of thinking. So yes. I think it's a problem that he isn't identified with he isn't identified in the public eye with the thing he wishes he was identified with.
Yeah, and it's like he will create 5 or 6 distractions a week. Look, if you could like implant yourself in Trump's brain and say, just focus on the economy, just economy all the time, don't deviate from the economy, that's all you need to really talk about, then I think he'd be a favorite for re-election. I think the odds are quite low that he'll do that. and we have a lot of history in the country. The other thing, too, is like, just as there are people who approve of him on the economy, but not overall, there are also people that only approve of him overall because of the economy. And if the economy were to turn south, then his numbers might turn south as well.
But don't you think there's a chance that those people, okay, let's say the economy doesn't turn south, don't you think there's a chance those people who don't like the extracurricular stuff, don't like the Mueller stuff, don't like the tweets, but like the economy, that they'll vote for him in 2020?
If that's the focus of his reelection campaign, maybe.
Well, it depends on the messaging, right? But what I'm saying is, like, right now the economy is at what most people would think is potentially a high watermark. Who knows? Maybe we'll get to 2.9% unemployment. It'd be great for the country. But the economy is more likely statistically to worsen than to improve. People have relatively short memories. So if you have an unemployment rate that's low but increasing, people's sentiments can be fairly negative around that. And so, you know, historically, economic performance a year and a half out or 2 years out is actually slightly inversely correlated with how the president does 2 years later, because their business cycles, if you're at the peak of a cycle now, and they're not that regular, believe me, so it's a noisy correlation, but it might mean that there's more downside than upside potentially. And so the bearish way to look at it is that if the economy is, you know, objectively really good, at least in the aggregate, not necessarily for individual people, but for many people, and he's only at 43% despite that, then where's he wind up if the economy is mediocre? I do think there are also like some Republican partisans. I mean, you know, basically, look, I think people have lots of theories for why Trump is more popular than polls show, and I think those theories are mostly not all that smart. I do think, though, we're in a world where the Democratic nominee will probably also be quite unpopular, and so maybe 43 or 44% would be enough, potentially. And he is at 43% now and not 39 as he was after the shutdown. That's somewhat meaningful. 43, by the way, among all Americans probably means like 44% among likely voters, so-called. So every marginal point helps. If he's in the mid-40s overall versus the low 40s or the high 30s, that matters.
Yeah, sure. And I don't think that because he has a good approval number on the economy that that means he's like a favorite or a strong favorite, at least, to win re-election. I guess I do think, though, it's a good check on people who look at the Mueller stuff, look at all the controversies. It's very easy nowadays to sort of think everyone's mind is made up on Trump. There's two camps and they don't overlap at all. But there is this group that is thinking about Trump in a fairly nuanced way, which suggests to me there's room for Trump to do better and obviously for Trump to do worse.
So let's wrap on this. In that same CNN poll where Trump got 56% approval on the economy, he got 38% approval on healthcare. So should people be paying as much attention to that number that's worse than his overall approval as they are to the economic approval, Claire?
It's certainly an important number, especially since the Democrats are going to be running on healthcare in 2020, and he has a really big problem with that. I mean, even he said, you know, the Republicans are going to be the party of healthcare. Well, it's not really shaping out that way, And I think that, you know,
that was a laugh line.
You know, I think that Democrats have figured out pretty easily that healthcare and their healthcare talking points are a lot more popular than Trump's. And that and electability, I think, will be kind of the big factors in the Democratic primary. So, yeah, it's a bit of a problem for him.
So all told, good use of polling or bad use of polling? I guess, Micah, you kind of think it's a good-ish use of polling. Nate, you think it's a bad use of polling?
No, I mean,
good use of polling or bad use of polling?
Bad use of polling.
All right, bad use of polling.
No, it's a good use of polling. It's a bad use if you're like, I don't know, I have issues with the way that people design some of these models that like, oh, plug in the GDP and plug in approval rating.
Galen thought he was ending the segment, but Nate's going to go off on polling.
The models have nothing to do with the poll.
It's a good use of polling.
It's a good use of polling.
It's a good question for CNN to ask.
As a poll.
It's but an informative
the question.
The
question is it good to
is it good extrapolation
to say that Trump has decent re-election odds?
Well, he does have decent re-election odds.
All right, fair enough. That's
good use. I won that one.
All right, let's move on and talk about the evolution of the Republican Party. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy. And you only have to go to one place to get it done. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address. It's ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, for the next part of today's show, we... Oh. Hey, yeah! Thank you. Yeah, that was fun.
Is that like the ZipRecruiter boss?
It's for Galen's
Houston's
reading comprehension.
Houston's a business-friendly town.
Yeah. It is, yeah.
For the next part of today's show, we actually have a special guest joining us, and that's Erica Greeter. Come on out, Erica. Erica is a Metro columnist at the Houston Chronicle. She's the former Southwest correspondent for The Economist and the author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. Let's hear it for Texas. For Erica, of course. So the question that we want to address is what happened to the Republican Party of George W. Bush? But before we get to that, let's begin by asking what we mean by the Republican Party of George W. Bush. So, Erica, how would we identify it in terms of, say, ideology, demographics? What was that party?
You know, it's funny to compare that party, however you define it, to the party that is the Republican Party today. We would think about Bush in terms of ideology as more pro-business, maybe more centrist, certainly more pro-trade, more in favor of the international order and the institutions associated with it. And I think, you know, this relates to demographics, more inclusive as a party. I mean, that wasn't an ideological stance per se, but I think from having, you know, began his career in politics in Texas, even at the time that he began that career in the 90s, there was already a sense that you can't be a party that can win in this state or in this country if you're a party of just white people. So you have to make sure you're reaching out to communities beyond just that.
So his coalition was in some way informed by his experience in Texas. Was his ideology informed by Texas?
I mean, I would certainly think so. There are certain issues that would come to mind in Texas, and the issues that we're talking about a lot these days, immigration, border security, trade policy, business development, education. I mean, those are things that as the governor of the state, I mean, even if that's your first job in politics, would sort of be central to you. And so then I guess that wasn't maybe built into his ideology in the first place, but that would be, you know, enforced through his actual governance.
Was it something particular about Bush's presidency? And Micah, Claire, Nate, get in on this. Was it something about Bush's presidency in particular that started a kind of change within the party?
It went really badly, I think. I mean, this chart, I mean,
For the listeners at home, there is a slide behind us tracking George W. Bush's approval rating over the 2 terms. Probably a lot of people actually know this one by heart, but it basically goes from the high 80s to below 25%.
No, and you obviously, we were all alive and paying attention during this administration, so you remember it. But you look at this chart and it's like, wow. And I do think that the fact that it went so poorly created somewhat of a vacuum, maybe, in the party that allowed some of these destabilizing forces to creep in.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at Bush's campaign, Bush's gubernatorial term, you know, how he was talking about Latinos are natural conservatives. We should be recruiting them. You go to sort of the, I guess what I would call it, like, the end of the regular Republican era with the postmortem after 2012 when Romney lost and Republicans said, we do actually need to get more Latinos into the party to be a lasting thing. But the Tea Party came out of George W. Bush spent a whole lot of money. People felt betrayed by that as a conservative principle. And then you also had just kind of the rolling effects of Obama won the election. You had the Tea Party. And I think that it's bookended to a certain extent of there was some innovation in Bush's Republic, you know, what was it? Compassionate conservatism, right? And that is something that I would say that the Republican Party has pretty much gone the opposite of right now.
I mean, if you want to use a fairly lazy heuristic.
Sure.
We love lazy heuristics at 538.
If you want to kind of blame or
that's
credit.
That's going to be branded content. Yeah.
But describe the current state of the GOP. Here's a lazy heuristic I think is probably not terrible. So let's say a quarter of it is about Trump himself. A quarter of it is the Bush years. I don't just mean Bush himself, but I think there are a lot of important things happening in the Bush years, including how the media landscape changes. And the rise of the partisan media on the right, I think, is important and overlooked. I think a quarter of it has to do with long-term trends toward more partisanship, which dates back at least to the mid-90s, some people would say to the 70s and so forth. And probably a quarter of it is, I think, a GOP reaction to Obama in various ways, including him being the first black president, including him kind of transitioning into power at the time this financial crisis is worsening and the implications of that. And so I think you have some kind of mix of those four.
You gave us four reasons for why the Republican Party changed from the Republican Party of George W. Bush to the Republican Party of Trump. Erica, do you agree with those four?
I wish I had a slide about those things.
So it was, SparkNotes version. It was Trump himself, reaction to Obama,
Bush
as president,
long-term partisanship.
Okay, I think those are all certainly factors in play. An interesting thing to watch in the state has been that, of course, this is a red state, and Trump underperformed here. He didn't win the primary. He lost by 17 points to Senator Ted Cruz. And, there was not a lot of enthusiasm for Trump at the time. There's more of the sense of there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court. He's the party nominee. And even the leaders who were saying vote for the nominee were saying vote for the nominee. So, I mean, there's a clear consciousness among voters of this is a different kind of Republican, not the kind we're super enthused about. And so now, in the past couple of years, they've been in this sort of tension of the party's clearly changed in a much more Trumpian direction, including the state party, when in some sense, I think what they were sort of voting for at the time was just that's the nominee, he's probably going to lose, the polls suggest he's going to lose.
I'm kind of curious about your observations of Ted Cruz on a state and national level, because in the 2016 primary, he was, constitutional conservatism. He was the guy who gave the not-so-concession speech at the convention, Does Ted Cruz tell us anything about Texas Republicans in the age of Trump? I mean, how has he kind of acted in ways that maybe national observers wouldn't have caught on to?
That's an interesting question. I think that at the time of the primary, of course, it was a very crowded primary, again, 17 candidates, and Cruz had started out with a strategy to sort of be the candidate, to sort of just like stay in the primary and win through attrition. So he started out giving his opening speech at Liberty University, and you could kind of see that he was looking at polling showing him as the second or third choice of all these candidates. So he's going to wait till Rand Paul drops out and Rick Santorum drops out and kind of eventually just be him versus Jeb Bush and the final fight for the nomination. But then as the primary happened, once Trump got in, I think he sort of recognized the sort of that Trump was the front runner in all the polls. I mean, really the whole way through. Once he got to be the front runner, Ben Carson briefly overtook him in October. But basically, it was Trump all the time. And so you saw Cruz kind of pivot. And to me, it seemed kind of clear from that point that given the crowded field and given the sort of mood of the electorate, it was very pie in the facey. It wasn't going to be a Jeb Bush kind of year after all, or a Marco Rubio kind of year. He then fought Trump very bitterly through the primary. I think the speech he gave in Cleveland was probably how he felt. I think he then decided to support the nominee under pressure from both donors and voters, saying this is the party's nominee, you can't be this public sort of, critic. And now to watch him sort of, work through the Trump administration or work with them, I can't imagine that's a fun position. And it's certainly yielded some cryptic behavior.
Because Ted Cruz was super interesting to me because I think he had the same theory of the case in 2016, mm-hmm. frankly, that I did. I think that a lot of people did, which was that really conservative orthodoxy, conservative purity mm-hmm. was the North Star of the Republican base. And that if you strayed far from that on taxes or immigration or any of the main issues, that you couldn't win a Republican primary. And so I think when Trump came in, I think a lot of people were like, wait a second, his stances on healthcare or Social Security or abortion is going to doom him. And it didn't. So now a lot of people are sort of left is like, what is that North Star? Is it just Trump now? Or is there something else? Have you seen any sort of clues to that in how either Texas voters or the Texas GOP as a party has responded to Trump? Because we were talking a little backstage about how they've sort of come to grips with a Trump-led party.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that one thing I would say, and this is probably true in other red states as well, is that part of the reason that Texas Republicans seem so underwhelmed by Trump is they already had a model in their mind of like what a Republican who can win is. So I would occasionally get into this argument with friends I had who were, you know, Trump, and they were kind of thinking Trump is the only chance to beat Hillary Clinton. I was like, that's just such a weird thing to say. Like, Trump is the only chance you have to beat Hillary Clinton. There's like 17 candidates in this primary.
Yeah.
And then they kind of go to this, like, well, you know, we never win anymore. We're fighting this rearguard action to, you know, save conservatism. And Trump's not a traditional vehicle for our principles, but, you know, he's the only one we've got. And it's like, it's just so weird to me. Starting with the sense of like, we are permanently doomed to defeat. And I eventually came to think it was a sort of very California inflected view of national politics, right? And I guess if you're from California, it would make sense to think that Republicans can't win because they haven't won in a long time.
Right.
And I didn't succeed in winning that argument with those friends.
So when it comes to why the party started to evolve out of the Bush years, we've talked about that. You know, it was dissatisfied from the financial crisis, debt and deficit. You know, there were all kinds of reasons to be unhappy, the war in Iraq, et cetera. They're all listed behind me. Why did it choose the path that it did specifically? And Claire, you've been kind of like tracking through, you know, this landmark piece that we published, The End of a Republican Party, that you wrote in 2016. Do you have a sense of why?
I think a lot of it is, I would say, like, the big reaction. I mean, Romney was kind of the perfect foil to Trump in a lot of ways. Both rich guys, rich in very different ways, right? You know, the whole line about Trump was a poor person's idea of what a rich person was, I think is a good, but it's a good way to think about it, because the movement that the Republican Party went in after 2012 was basically a populist strain of conservatism. And I would say that we talked about this a lot during the primary, but that the Republican establishment or the Republican elites were out of touch with that. And they were out of touch with the concept of, well, maybe not all of the Tea Party movement is, you know, explicitly about taxes. Maybe there's actually, you know, we know that there's maybe a little bit of racism against Obama, but, I mean, you'll look at something like Identity Crisis, which is a really good book that I always cite. It's a look back at the 2016 election, and those political scientists found that there was a lot of sort of Obama-connected people were reacting in a kind of racial animus way to Obama. So there was a lot of, I think, populist and sort of racist forces that they hadn't actually grappled with very well, in part because they were spending 2012, 2013 writing a postmortem that was very, let's be a more multicultural party, let's actually come up with a solution for immigration. And it kind of whiplashed, where the base basically said, that's not what we want. And it has to do with these demographic forces.
Yeah.
But the party was getting older and whiter and less college educated. I mean, we talked a lot in the midterms about the swing of white college educated people to more and more into the Democratic Party, which used to be a pretty solid Republican bet that you could get those voters. So I think that the GOP has just seen an aging and a whitening of the party when the rest of the country is going to be, by what's the year now, 2044 or something,
yeah,
going to be a majority-minority country.
I think one thing I learned in 2016, where we were, you know, pretty skeptical about Trump's chances, very skeptical until really just before Iowa. I think partisanship and identity come before policy in most voters' mind. Because I kind of thought, like Micah, you're like, well, I can understand the abstract how someone who's a media star and Trump is good at manipulating the media, et cetera, et cetera. I can understand how that might work. Like, I could understand how, like, a Sarah Palin, for example, if she had run, could have maybe won the nomination. But he's way out of GOP orthodoxy on policies ranging from abortion, where historically he's a bit wobbly, to gay marriage, where it had historically been a big thing. He seems kind of indifferent about it, to criticizing the last three GOP nominees, toward foreign policy, toward trade, whatever else. And people don't care about that stuff that much, right? Maybe the Marco Rubio voters do. And Houston's probably a Marco Rubio kind of town. But that's like...
Oh, wait, that was a... That idea got rejected. What kind of town were you? Who did y'all vote for in the Republican primary? No! No! Who did you vote for in the 2016 Republican primary?
Okay.
Gary Johnson.
We got to make some outreach to
the
conservative listeners.
But Trump... Trump identified a new set of issues that allow people to like assert their political identity.
Well, he was an anti-institutionalist, right? And if you, yeah, look at the, if you look at the George, well, we're not on the slide, but like, what did George W. Bush do? He kind of proved that a lot of the institutions that Americans really believed in, the military, banks, the Supreme Court to a certain extent, but that was more on the Democratic side. He basically, that presidency and then the fact that Mitt Romney lost kind of proved to Republican voters, wait, actually these things don't work for you. And Trump was the person who was making fun of all this stuff. If you went to Trump rallies, they were fun and funny on some level, right? They were part, you know, he's good on the stump. He can be comedic. He can kind of, he'll say the thing that a, you don't expect a person on a stage to say. And people like that. There's a thrill in that. And I think the thrill was, yeah, these institutions have really screwed us over. We're going to vote for the guy who's actually articulating that.
So, Erica, would you say that the Republican Party today under Trump is more in line with the middle class on things like Social Security, Medicare, foreign intervention, you know, trade even?
No.
I mean, if the argument is that the Republican Party used to be the party of, like, out-of-touch elites and that Donald Trump was the one to kind of, like, bring it down to earth, those were obviously areas where he made significant changes to Republican Party orthodoxy. Was that to be more in line with voters, or is he now going against the wishes of Republican voters?
Well, you know, I think that was what we're all sort of pointing to. I'm not sure that the views, the heterodox views he espoused, I'm not sure that's what was drawing voters into the fold. I think that was really still up high in the face, I think, the transgressive, the anti, you know, the sort of anti-elite, the anti-media, the sort of narrative of grievance, the sort, and also in the corollary, like at the rallies, I love you, it's so great to be here with you, you're all my friends, you know, I'm in this small town. And so, you know, it sounds simplistic. I mean, we want to kind of impute a policy or ideological agenda into that, but I think that you wonder how much different the primary would have been had he been more orthodox as a conservative, just by chance, but also as belligerent in his tone, as aggressive and as, you know, pugilistic. But going right now, I think that you see Republicans who are in elected office paying more attention, I guess, to the sort of concerns of the working man. But to me, they seem like they're sort of neurotically trying to figure out how Trump is appealing to these voters, because they had been sort of the option for their voters, and now they're trying to sort of be the stewards of what he's speaking for, but not really having been based in that themselves.
Also, the party in Washington hasn't strayed far from conservative orthodoxy. I mean, if you look at Congress, the issues they focus on, the bills they passed, are really, with like very few exceptions, kind of straight line Republican orthodoxy. So I don't think we necessarily learned that. Like, I don't think the Republican Party became more populist because of Trump, or became more in line with middle class voters. I think we just learned that these other set of issues weren't driving voters. We didn't necessarily learn that this new set of issues was driving voters. At least I don't think those kind of populist issues. I mean, if you look at this, like, in a lot of ways, the defining feature of the modern Republican Party is it's being cut off from the rest of the country, ideologically, demographically, in terms of media consumption, and in that silo, I think you create all kinds of different dynamics that can like fester and sort of compound in on themselves,
or be powerful electoral forces, because you're an out group and you feel
totally
camaraderie with people everywhere. And if you come to see, say, the media, the general media, as your enemy, then you go out in the midterms and you have historic turnouts, right? Because you feel like, well, we're going to show them.
No, totally. And I think like maybe actually the driving force now is, you know, an anti-institutional sentiment, or just like a us versus them sentiment. And that can take on an institutional frame. It can take on a racial frame. It can take on a nationalistic frame. But it's this us versus them dynamic.
You kind of framed it as the Republican Party is apart from the rest of the country. Obviously, until, you know, a matter of months ago, they were in control of all of the levers of power in Washington. Erica, Nate, do you think it's fair to describe the Republican Party as apart from the country as a whole? So I'll also just say, for listeners at home, the chart that we're showing behind us tracks the Republican Party in comparison to the country by age, education, and race. And it does show that the Republican Party is kind of charting its own path away from the trends of the nation overall. But, like, why then does it have until very recently, all the power in Washington. Is it really apart from the country?
Well, first of all, you do have, for different reasons, the Electoral College, the House, and the Senate all presently allow the GOP to overperform and basically get majority number of seats with a minority of the vote. That's an important factor. You know, second is like the Paul Ryan agenda is not very popular. And in some ways, the Paul Ryan agenda was defeated in the 2016 primary, but it wound up being what voters got anyway. If you look at polling on Trump, there was a poll out today. I forget who it's from. I apologize. People who voted for Obama in 2012 and Trump in 2016 now only approve of Trump at about a 65% rate, which given they all voted for Trump is not that high. Conversely, people who shifted away from the GOP, so people who voted, for example, for Romney in 2012 and then voted for Gary Johnson or Evan McMullen, their Trump approval has increased. So in some ways, you're seeing like some reversion to the fact that like I think voters actually thought that Trump was running on a somewhat moderate platform, being more protective of Social Security and Medicare, promised something ambiguous on Obamacare to repeal it, but something better to replace it. And they kind of wound up not getting that. And so you've seen, I don't know, but like that's important to point out too.
And polls did show during the primary that voters rated Trump as the most moderate of the candidates. So this cuts against what I was arguing earlier, but maybe.
But in reality, in his governing, he has been.
No, totally. But I'm saying like maybe Nate's right that like that the idea that Trump might be a president who protected Social Security and Medicare, but was strong on defense, you know, was like this kind of like hodgepodge, this like third way dream candidate. Maybe that did play some small role, and the fact that he has governed totally from GOP orthodoxy will now limit that appeal in 2020.
This kind of gets at one of the questions I wanted to wrap up on, actually, which is anybody today making the case for the Republican Party of George W. Bush? And Erica, I imagine maybe if they are, it's in Texas, I'm not sure, but what would you say to that?
Well, yeah, actually there are. So in Texas, you know, there's this real sense of among the Republicans who care about the party, who care about the party, Quay party, who, you know, volunteered for the party, have been elected officials in the party, you know, there are a lot of them in the state. And like the party they built was not this sort of Pappy-Cannonite party that we're currently seeing on the national stage. But they have not thus far had much success in their efforts to reform the party itself. I mean, there are still individuals out there, including in office, who are still articulating those views, but they're not really getting much traction in the Trump era. What I think is an interesting group is that you notice in 2018, the midterm elections, so we had, you know, historic, unprecedented turnout levels for a midterm election in Texas, which is a state with notoriously low turnout. And so it's not an exact comparison, but in the presidential race in Texas, you have Trump winning by 9% against Hillary Clinton. And then in the Senate race, Ted Cruz winning re-election by less than 3 points against Beto. And then also there are four statewide races where it was less than 5 points, the margin, which is not really what anyone would have guessed after 2014. And I think what we saw in exit polls, and they're a bit, you know, we don't have great data sets because we haven't had a really robust competitive general election scene for a while in Texas. But you saw a lot of the shift, you know, a surge in turnout on both sides, a higher surge in turnout on the Democratic side. Democrats have more room to grow in general in Texas. But then one thing you saw where Cruz outperformed Trump was among Latino Republicans. And so Trump underperformed pretty seriously. And I think there was a sense among Latino Republicans that I was talking to that because of the long-term trajectory, the demographics we've all talked about, this trajectory the party is currently on at the national level just can't be sustained. There aren't enough white people to sustain Trumpism long-term. And in Texas, it's already true. If Cruz had won the same percent of Latino voters that Trump did, he would have lost. I mean, that's more than enough to make up the margin. And so I think that in talking to some of these sources who care about the party, who are conservatives, who've been with the party, voted for George W. Bush, voted for Rick Perry, they have a sense that they have leverage because the party has to keep them in the coalition.
Ted Cruz is the future of the Republican Party? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, sure. That makes sense.
I mean, do you think the future... We started this off by saying that the history of 3 decades of the Republican Party was in Texas. Do you think the future of the Republican Party is in Texas?
I mean, I think that there are certain skills that had, among the Democrats in Texas, that had atrophied over the course of a generation of one-party rule, right? But there are certain skills that had not atrophied. I mean, if you were a Democrat in Texas, if you were in the legislature, if you were in local government, you had to work really hard to get anything done. You had to work with your colleagues on both sides of the aisle. You had to be smart. You had to know the rules of like the chamber if you're in the legislature. You had to be able to make your case to the voters. And so I think that as we see Democrats now starting to run their bench and we're seeing new candidates emerge and contest all these races, they have a lot of skills. And the Republicans have gotten somewhat used, I think, to just being able to say, this is our policy, we're imposing it. And that's no longer the case. So in the very short term, I would not say that the Texas Republican Party is going to reclaim the national party.
If we had to pick a state that represented the future of the Republican Party at this point in time, what do you guys think?
That's a hard question. I mean, I do think you do see in Texas pretty clearly some dynamics that the Republican Party is confronting in the Trump era nationally. The move of, as Claire was mentioning, college-educated voters to Democrats, and this looming threat of Latino voters registering and turning out, you know, all combined with like the urbanization of the state. So, you know, to Erica's point of like the Republican Party is not used to having to innovate or work to get what it wants. Maybe it will soon, and so you will see some of the what's going on nationally here. If I had to pick one state to capture the national Republican Party,
I don't know. I think there are a lot of
the future of the
not to interrupt your thought, but like I think it's in a lot of states of like where states that are the Republican state legislature is doing a really good job accomplishing their legislative agenda. You could say places like Missouri and Georgia and Ohio. You could go to Scott Walker's Wisconsin. I think a lot of it comes from like the state level of where are these very innovative ideas to get their agenda accomplished coming from. And I don't know what state specifically has like the standout, you know, next generation.
I mean, Florida is one answer that I think stands out. But I have no idea how to predict the future of the Republican Party, in part because the scenario where Trump loses seems extremely opposite to me from the scenario where he wins, right? If he loses, the GOP says, you know what?
Analysis.
In fact,
but more so than if Obama had lost in 2012, yeah. I think, right? Because the narrative you can tell yourself if he loses is that, oh my gosh, we haven't won the popular vote since 2004. You know, Trump got a little bit done in 2 years. We got our ass kicked at the midterms, then again in 2020, right? And I'm sure we're very unpopular long term. And if he wins, you say, you know what? We can't really lose, right? If Trump can win, then, like, we can do whatever we want pretty much. And so whether it's 2024 or 2028, you're going to have, I think, a really unpredictable Republican primary after that.
All right. Well, I think on that, we're going to wrap things up. So thank you so much, Erica, for joining us today. Please give her a round. Again, Erica is a Metro columnist at the Houston Chronicle and author of Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. And now it is time for a Democratic primary draft. This is what they came for. Before we get to the draft, however, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by 1-800-FLOWERS. After a childhood full of unsuccessful attempts to pull the wool over your mom's eyes, do you really think she wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a last-minute Mother's Day gift and something truly thoughtful? This Mother's Day, don't settle for anything less than the biggest, brightest bouquet from 1-800-Flowers.com. 1-800-Flowers has amazing offers on beautiful Mother's Day bouquets and arrangements starting at $29.99. She'll never guess how great of a last-minute deal you scored. Mother's Day bouquets and arrangements starting at $29.99 is an amazing offer, but you have to order soon because it's only good while supplies last. After you've chosen your gorgeous bouquet or arrangement, simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. Trust 1-800-Flowers to make Mother's Day special. To order beautiful and vibrant Mother's Day bouquets starting at $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code POLITICS. Order today and save at 1-800-Flowers.com, code POLITICS.
When is Mother's Day?
Sunday.
Oh, come on. When is Mother's Day?
Sunday is Mother's Day, people. Don't forget.
You know, it's funny. We were driving here from Austin, and we were listening to Rush Limbaugh on the radio. And we heard him read a 1-800-Flowers ad, and I was like, oh my God, we're one of a kind. You guys agree?
Money talks, you know? It's like, and if you want to advertise with us, just reach out. We'll, you know, anyway, we'll take anything.
Personal, classified, whatever, you know, anything.
Oh my God, what if we did that? What if we did, like, classified? Do you know how, like, what's the literary magazine that does, like, singles ads in the back? Does anyone know what I'm doing? It's like the
Would anybody have a singles ad that they want to advertise?
I feel like 538
we'll talk after
a very specific
show.
Type, but that could work.
538 singles. Yeah.
We're going to start 530. We're going to start 530 date.
538,
yeah. Put me on the business team, Micah.
We did. Slow your roll. We did have this idea to do a dating column where we gave a single person all this data from a dating site about how people behave on dates and like arm them with it and send them out on dates and then to write about it. It never happened though. I don't know why.
Okay. On to the draft. There are now 21 Democrats vying for the party's nomination. As I mentioned, about 6 of them have joined the ring since the last time we had a Democratic primary draft in March. So it's time for another one. You'll be able to follow along behind us. Listeners at home, you'll just have to remember who we picked. And just to specify, we are drafting candidates who we think have the best shot of winning the Democratic primary, not the best shot of winning the presidency necessarily, just to make that distinction. And last time we did this, we started with Nate. So this time, let's start with Claire. And this is a snake draft. So we'll end with Nate, but then he'll get to pick 2, and then we'll go back around. So Claire, who are you drafting first?
My first round draft pick is Joe Biden.
What?
Boring pick.
Boring.
Boring, but very the right pick.
Yeah.
Very. Biden that was a sarcastic one.
Biden is doing very well in the field right now. And I think if we're going by, what day is it? May 9th? May 8th? Whenever this is.
Guys, what day is it?
Hey.
This Biden looks pretty good. He is polling well across a lot of groups. He's seen by a lot of people as a good strategic choice, even if they don't think that Biden represents their views the best of all the candidates. They think he has the best chance of appealing to people who might have voted for Trump last time. So I think Joe Biden is a pretty safe and good first-round draft pick.
I won't challenge that too much.
Nate will.
Yeah, no, look, no, it's the obvious pick. In fact, I wanted to have an auction instead of a draft if you play fantasy football or whatever, because I think Biden is, like, a pretty clear number one at this stage.
All right, so Claire's got it, though. Now we move on to Micah.
Going second right now is, like, the worst possible position to go because there's not a clear I don't think there's a clear second choice. But I'm going to pick Kamala Harris. So I think right now, again, there's not a clear second candidate, but I think right now she offers the best combination of actually performing well on some metrics. So in other words, in national polls, she does okay. Not great. She's in like the high single digits. She's raised some money. In other words, there's like tangible evidence that she's doing okay. But then also, I think she offers a ton of upside. In other words, if you lay out the kind of main constituencies within the Democratic Party, you can kind of be like, oh, Harris would do well with that group.
She's
and that
breakout
group
potential.
And that group. Yeah, so she has a high ceiling. Now, you could say that of other candidates, but Harris is actually, so far at least, putting kind of some meat on the bone. That's not the right metaphor, but...
I mean, I think if you like... look at the overlap of which candidates have traditional profiles of someone who would get nominated by a party. And there's more than one profile like that, but she's in that part of the Venn diagram. And it overlaps with people who have some kind of pulse in the polling.
Right.
Maybe not a very vigorous pulse, but some type of pulse. And I think she is one of the candidates in that overlap.
Do you worry at all, Micah, that she's kind of a Marco Rubio of 2020, where she makes a lot of sense on paper? You can see her appealing to various constituencies, but we haven't seen it in the polling so far, so why should we expect it to happen anytime soon?
Oh, there's like a real, real chance that happens. Totally, yeah. Look, she might never break into double digits in the polling. We get to Iowa, we get to New Hampshire. She doesn't do well, and therefore doesn't have sort of any momentum going into South Carolina, Nevada. So sure, yeah, that could definitely happen. But like, I think she'll do really well in the debates. I think she can make some of the electability arguments that Biden is making. I think she can make some of the policy arguments that Warren is making. So she just can appeal to a lot of different groups.
All right,
it's your pick.
It's my pick. I am going to go with Elizabeth Warren.
Woo!
She was next on my list.
Would you say that that was the loudest applause so far?
Out of three.
Out of three. Okay. All right. So there's my answer. No, I'm kidding. So if you look at what happened in the Republican Party in 2012, you had an extremely motivated right flank of the party in the Tea Party that was pushing hard on the establishment to take pretty like strong orthodox positions on core policies. At the same time, you had an establishment that wanted somebody with ties to them, like somebody that they understood, they felt was one of them. And that ended up being Mitt Romney. He could stand as a strong conservative on things like immigration and the economy, et cetera, but he was Republicans in Washington and the Republican Party apparatus felt like he was still one of us. So I would say that I could see Elizabeth Warren being able to tie both key parts of the party together in order to win the primary, meaning she can speak to people who care deeply about policy on the left. You know, she articulates it really well. If you watched her town halls, she gets people excited based on her progressive policies. However, she said she's still a capitalist. She has friends on Capitol Hill. She would very easily get the backing from the establishment that Bernie Sanders, the other person who shares a lot of those policy positions, might not. So she is my Mitt Romney of 2020. I know maybe you guys don't like that comparison, but that's how she wins the Democratic primary.
I think here's your problem with Elizabeth Warren. Which is, I think she's all of those things. She is the left that the establishment is comfortable with. But I think in a lot of ways, this primary, the test will be whether or not she can overcome the fact that Trump has kind of already pegged her with this quite viral attack, right? And, you know, I was talking to someone who basically said, I think whoever Trump hasn't defined yet will be the person who can defeat Trump. And in some ways, Trump has defined Elizabeth Warren in part because she's been a high-profile senator. She had, you know, a little bit of a high-profile flub on her announcement, you know, whatever, that kind of played into Trump's hand. And I do think that that has given people a little bit of a jolt back about Warren. So that's, I would say that's like the big question mark with her.
I do think, look, if you had made this pick like 2 weeks ago, I would be more surprised. But she has started to show a little bit of life in the data since Biden got in the race.
Right? Well, since she called for impeachment, too. Like, she understands that left flank
she's
of the
certainly
party.
She's a person who is, like, I think we talked about this in the other podcast, whereas, like, Beto is kind of like, should I, he kind of, when someone asked the impeachment question, he equivocated for a while, and then a few days later came out for it. Whereas Warren has been a person who will often be the first person out of a 21 candidate field to say something substantive and to kind of make headlines on that front. The Electoral College stuff was a Warren news cycle to a certain extent. So she does kind of put it all out there.
And also wait for those debates. She might be able to redefine herself out of whatever Trump has defined her as. We will see. But anyway, let's move on to Nate.
So with number four, I'll take Bernie Sanders.
Wow.
Limited but very enthusiastic.
Yeah, which kind of tells you something, right? But, like, look, I have been bearish on Bernie relative to a lot of people. I think relative to, like, people on Twitter, for example. And you can read the case for why I am a little bit bearish. Go back to the website. I'm just going to focus right now on, like, purely what I think is the realistic, not Pollyanna-ish upside case for him. Asset number one. His fundraising is very good, and I think more sustainable than either Beto's or Biden. So he's not going to run out of money. He can run a robust campaign that will help on Super Tuesday, for example. He has a big staff, a professional staff, and that helps. Asset number two is New Hampshire, where he's, I think, probably still the most likely candidate to win New Hampshire. And again, I'm making the optimistic case, and so I think there are reasons why he would win New Hampshire and then not get very far with that, but that would tend to keep him in the game, potentially. You know, option number three, he is second in the polling. He is closer to third than to first, but he has sustained that over a longer period of time than other candidates have.
I think your big problem is, look, Sanders has always been a kind of a factional candidate. In the kind of poli-sci sense of the word, where he does have this, like, really loyal base. But over the past, like, month or so, having a really devoted faction that's, like, 20% of the party is one thing. Having a really devoted faction that's closer to like 10% of the party, I don't think that gets you very far.
15 maybe, and we're seeing polls among...
No, but, and that's in between.
But we're also seeing polls among registered voters and not likely voters, and his campaign between having more enthusiastic supporters and having a robust infrastructure to turn voters out could overperform its polls, at least, or at least its registered voter polls. So, and again, you know, I think in a field of 20 or 21, then having the assets you have as Bernie Sanders probably makes you at least... He's second or third or fourth or fifth. This group of four candidates can go in any order in pretty much.
He's definitely like an obvious going to be one of the top five or six candidates out there who will be serious contender. I think, again, to go to like the idea that Democrats want someone who's, again, not just like a strategic choice, but Sanders will be, he's going to like throw some fire ants into the pants of the Democratic establishment no matter what. And I think that that might make some people nervous. Even if they like Sanders, they might say, yikes, maybe he's going to be a little bit too pugilistic. I think an interesting indication of that is some very high-profile people who worked for Sanders have gone to other campaigns, Biden notably, right? So I think that that is a little bit of an interesting indicator about, you know...
There's some tactical dynamic, too, where if you play, like, the board game Risk, right, people gang up on the most powerful country. Now that people have...
There was an applause
for Risk.
Now people are, like, ganging up on Biden, which is the correct thing to do. You know, it's like Bernie is, like, Australia or something, right? He's being left alone. He can get a lot of armies in Australia. And so the fact that people might, you know, Kamala Harris, the article in the New York Times say about, oh, she actually moved too far to the left, and now she's trying to pivot between, like, Bernie and Biden, which I think is smart for her, but that might also help Bernie, potentially, or Warren is trying to differentiate herself by being more... more wonky and more policy oriented. Again, I'm not like super optimistic, but we're down already to people who probably have a 10 or 15 or 20% chance to win the nomination, and like that's not that high.
All right, so we now have our first four on the board. We are going to do the next round 2x speed. So pick your next person.
I'll go with Pete Buttigieg.
We got a member of the audience wearing a Boot Edge t-shirt in the front row.
Very helpful. Thank you. I wish we could just put every candidate's name on someone's t-shirt so we could remember them all.
So if you had a model that's purely based on polls, but is allowed to look at polls in a more sophisticated way, isn't just kind of who's first, second, third. He has a lot of bullish indicators in the polling, one of which is that he's at 7 or 8%, but with much lower name recognition than Warren, for example. So on that basis, he's reasonably strong. He's polling better in Iowa and New Hampshire than nationally, where he's often at 10 or 11 or 12%, sometimes gets in second place in those polls. His favorability ratings are as good or better, again, just for name recognition, as anyone else in the field. You know, I do think that like we're going to reach a phase of heightened scrutiny if we haven't already. And I'm not sure it'll just be kind of the scrutiny you get from the left or whatever, but like scrutiny in terms of like, you
You're
know,
the mayor
is there,
of a
is there
small
the experience you have, you know, the kind of question you ask yourself, like, okay, 3 a.m. phone call and there's a report of a North Korea, you know, missile on the way. You know, I think there'll be some scrutiny there potentially. I think he, although is trying to expand his appeal to black voters, has not done that yet, certainly. Like in weird ways, I actually find Mayor Pete and Bernie kind of similar. They're both...
Somebody in the front goes, hmm?
They're both non-traditional candidates, right? Buttigieg is not well-credentialed enough for a traditional nominee, and Bernie is too factional for a traditional nominee. But they do very well with a certain important segment of the party. They're both going to, I think, raise money pretty well. You know, I think Buttigieg will be good in Iowa and New Hampshire as Bernie was 4 years ago. So I kind of see them as being similar.
All right, Claire.
Okay.
Your second pick.
Yeah. So I think now we're into the realm of like the, it could be anyone's game here. And I think there are two people I'm picking between here, Beto O'Rourke and Amy Klobuchar.
Oh, you're so right.
Oh,
wait,
no.
What?
We messed up. It's a snake draft.
Oh, man.
If we didn't have all these 538 readers in the audience, we wouldn't even know how to do our own game.
Oh, because you didn't go twice.
Yeah.
I was barely paying attention.
I was too. All right, well, Galen, I've kind of given go for it. It's in my opinion, it's either Beto O'Rourke or Amy Klobuchar. So let's see which one you pick.
All right. Well, I'm in Texas and I'm just going for the applause, so I'm going to pick Beto O'Rourke.
Bad pick.
Bad pick.
Bad pick.
Obviously, the elephant in the room is that his polling fell from, you know, about 12%, low double digits, to now about 5%, mid-single digits. But if you listened to our podcast on Monday, you heard that Texas is nearing battleground status in 2020. And if we know one thing about what Democratic voters are prioritizing in the Democratic primary is its electability. And we can see this in polling that Democratic voters see Beto O'Rourke as improving when they take electability into account in the polling, improving in the polling. So given that Democrats want to run the board and try to, you know, do really well in places like Arizona and Texas, Florida, maybe even Georgia, I think that, you know, people who are prioritizing electability and kind of want to be able to run the board and compete in every state are going to pick Beto O'Rourke.
All right.
And he can raise a ton of money.
And he can raise a ton of money from y'all.
My pick?
Micah. No, no, no.
Micah.
Claire, you don't.
But we did. We already screwed up the snake draft. So like, shouldn't I?
You don't get any more picks. You just got that first pick.
I feel like I've really gotten screwed here.
Micah, you are a Slytherin. Remember?
I did. Yeah, on the Hogwarts test, I did come out as a Slytherin. But you did too.
Yeah. But you know who I would pick in the spot, knowing who Claire's pick is all I'm saying.
I know who he's going.
I think we're in, like, throw-the-dice territory here. I'm going to go... I do have my list here. I'm going to go with... I'll go with Klobuchar.
Wow. What a Slytherin move. I can see what you wrote on your list, and that was not the order.
Fuck. Yeah, no, I know.
That was just a personal attack.
We've been traveling together for a week. It's gotten a little shady.
Well, you know, it's like I respect your views very much, and so that you
pick her. That's why you picked it.
Klobuchar has a really clear case to make, which is like I can win Midwestern voters. The Midwest is really important. Vote for me.
People really like that argument. The woman right here is just like, no.
Yeah, that didn't get you on board? Well, I don't work for her, so maybe, you know, maybe that tells you. I think it's like we've made this case before, but look at Klobuchar's record, her electoral record, and it's really impressive. In a state, she overperforms year after year compared to someone like Warren, who, you know, I would have picked her high up too, but like, given how liberal Massachusetts is, her record doesn't look all that great.
She underperformed
a lot. So I think Klobuchar has like just a really good electoral record to run on. It hasn't really gotten her anywhere yet, which is a little surprising. I think it's an interesting conversation why that is. You know, certainly when she announced, she was kind of dogged by that story of like mistreating her staff. Maybe that's all it takes to kind of ruin a kickoff.
I think she's not she's not a flashy politician to begin with. I do actually think she's a very solid pick, in part because she kind of has a lot of space to grow in a lot of different ways. She's a woman candidate. She's going to make her whole case on, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. We can't do Medicare for all. I'm going to be the pragmatist. She's sort of like steady Eddie Amy, right?
And if Biden falters.
Yeah, if Biden falters and you kind of game out that, let's say you do have like smoke-filled rooms and people in the establishment saying, who can we trust that we think is electable? I do think they could turn to her, right? Oh, she's not too liberal and she's from the Midwest. She also is from a neighboring state to Iowa, which could help. I think she thinks she'll do well in the debates because she was a prosecutor, although Kamala Harris has that advantage too. Look, voters only know like one or two things about most of these candidates. If the first thing they learn is that, oh, here's this woman with a funny name who was abusive to her staff, then that perception can linger until they learn more. And even for Warren, who was a more of a household name, a lot of people heard about the DNA tests and nothing else.
I think that what's going to be maybe interesting for Klobuchar is, I think a couple days ago she rolled out an addiction program plan. And I think that that will actually, I'm actually surprised that I haven't heard more people. I was in New Hampshire a couple weeks ago. There wasn't that much talk about the opioid crisis, which was quite different from the Republican primary, where John Kasich and Chris Christie made that a little bit of the platform of their campaign. Klobuchar can tell the personal story of my father was a very bad alcoholic. I kind of know this up close and personal. And if you're looking to both sort of soften and strengthen a candidate who maybe had a bit of a unfortunate media rollout, I think that's a sort of valid way to do it. So I think she has interesting places to go.
All right. Good pick.
Yeah, it is a good pick.
Now, that wasn't actually your pick, so now you get two picks.
I feel like I'm just taking credit for Micah's pick right here. I'm going to go with Cory Booker.
Okay. Like, that too was on my list.
Golf clap.
Golf clap. I don't think Booker is a super strong candidate right now. He's polling at, 2 or 3% generally. But I think he has a few things in his favor. One, he's a U.S. senator. He's well-known in the era of confirmation hearings and explosive congressional testimony. He has a seat at the table. He can make media moments in a way that's much simpler than, say, John Hickenlooper or Jay Inslee. I also think Booker represents sort of the happy warrior theory of the case to beating Trump. So for people who want the let's not just be super negative, let's not be ranty and angry, let's just kind of hoof it out and put in the work, he's got that going for it. He is a black candidate, so there's a great proportion of the Democratic Party that is black voters. They're not going to necessarily vote as a monolith, obviously, especially given that they have a lot of choices this primary season, but that's certainly a strength that he has. And then lastly, I would say, I think he's the kind of person who's going to pour a lot of effort, and I already heard some indications of this, pour a lot of effort into campaigning in Iowa. And maybe he's going to be someone who will have sort of planted the seeds, and then over the next 18 months, next year or so, they'll really grow. So I think he has some upside potential to him.
All right, we're going to try to make it to four rounds. We're going to have to start the abridged version of the 2020 draft.
Castro! Inslee!
That's it. Oh, I'm not doing Castro. I'll go with Inslee.
What?
Yeah. Wait, there's somebody with a Beto hat clapping for Inslee, right? Yeah.
He contains...
Oh, he just changed allegiances. He just threw his Beto hat on.
There you go. He contains multitudes.
You've already convinced somebody.
Good. Again, upside potential. He's been a governor. I think he's running an interesting campaign in the sense that he has a single issue. It's an issue that's popular with the Democratic base, environmentalism. Like, I'm the guy with the actual Green New Deal, and I'm here to flesh it out for you. He's white. He's a man. I think that helps. There's my theory.
Yeah. All right, Micah.
I'll pick Castro. Look, Latino voters have never really voted as a cohesive block in a Democratic primary before, in the way that, black voters did for Clinton in 2016 or Obama in 2008. But, California's earlier this year, Texas is earlier this year, you have Nevada fairly early, and so if Castro can, find a moment to catch on sometime between now and Nevada, let's say, that's plenty of time, then I do think maybe he has this, coalition he can look to as a starting point to get a toehold and make some noise.
I am going to go with... probably the only person worth picking who's not in the race yet, and that is Stacey Abrams.
She was next on my list. That was Nate's pick.
Actually, JK, it's Bill de Blasio. No. It's definitely Stacey Abrams, and as you just said, Micah, African-American Democrats, historically, when they have gotten behind a Democrat in the primary, have gone en masse for that candidate, and a lot of times that candidate has been successful. I mean, look at Bill Clinton, look at Obama, look at Hillary Clinton. The big if is if she gets in the race, that's maybe, what would we say, 20% chance? Less than that?
I think less.
I think it's lower.
Lower than that? So yeah, I mean, it's kind of something like she waits another month if Biden starts to fade. Obviously right now, Biden is getting somewhere in the range of 50% of the African-American vote. If it doesn't actually seem like that is going to sustain itself, then, you know, she could find a place in the Democratic primary and do decently well. Again, we're, you know, third round.
I'll take Andrew Yang. I mean, like, look, you want high variance picks. And, like, Andrew Yang is someone who is not like a candidate we've really seen before. He's raised money from a lot of people, not all that much money. I think he'll be interesting on the debate stage. I think he has, like, a following online, which can help as more media coverage shifts online. But, again, like, we're not picking who is going to win the median number of delegates. Like, who has a chance for, like, this 2% miracle? And I'd probably pick him before, like, Michael Bennett with 1T or something.
All right. Who's your final round pick?
I think we are at the point now where Kirsten Gillibrand has to be drafted by someone, and that's me. Look, she is someone where, like, to say with the basketball analogies, right, she's like a former number one overall draft pick who is in the G League or something. It's, like, really not going very well, but the fundamentals are fairly sound.
What a tortured metaphor.
Okay, but, like, I'm looking forward to the Rockets game, so.
Wait, I think the Rockets game was the biggest applause line of the draft so far.
I think between Yang and the Rockets, Nate is just going for cheap applause line.
But the resume is pretty impressive, right? This this senator from a big state who formerly represented a swing district who has a theme around women. I think in general the women in the Democratic primary are undervalued for various reasons we don't have time to get into right now. You know, I don't know why it's not going at all well. Maybe Al Franken, yeah. Maybe she has to own that and embrace that a little bit more. But I think the coverage of her is fairly gendered as well. She seems not to have a lot of friends in the New York congressional delegation, only one endorsement so far. But for all that, we are talking about a senator who has been planning on running a campaign for a long time, who I think is pretty capable of figuring out how to appeal to different constituencies in the party. New York is a big, diverse state. And so with the 13th pick, that seems like a good value proposition.
Okay.
Snake draft back to me. All right. So I just said that I was picking the one person worth picking who's not in the race yet, but I changed my mind. I'm going to pick another person who's not in the race yet. Change things up a little bit here. I'm going to pick Mitch Landrieu.
Bad pick.
What?
For the listeners at home, we have a chart behind us with our picks, and Vanessa Diaz, who's in the control room, just wrote who in place of Mitch Landrieu.
Mitch.
All right, so as you can see from the arguments that I made for both O'Rourke and Abrams, the theory of that case is that the Democrats' path to redemption is through the Sun Belt. And Mitch Landrieu was a very popular mayor, I know, but, like, Pete Buttigieg was drafted in the second round, so, who can speak passionately about race in the South and has done so, you know, like, if you watched his speech about taking down Confederate monuments in New Orleans, that was a very impactful speech. No?
No.
I think we're, like, I think you need to make high variance picks now, as Nate said.
Wait, that was a high variance pick.
No,
yeah, but like, what,
not
like
really.
There are a lot of like other sort of like middling tier like white mayoral types or executive types you could pick from.
Yeah, but John Hickenlooper can't speak passionately and convincingly about race.
I'll give you.
But like, I don't think that people. I don't think that people necessarily.
See, he agrees with me.
I don't think that people necessarily want that from the white guy. That they like, if that's the theory of the case, like I think they
well,
want.
Well, let's
a little
watch
bit,
what Biden does.
Well, if they. If they do, though, too, it might be Beto first before...
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But I already have Beto. I can't pick him twice.
All right. It's
you guys really don't like my pick. Okay, anyway.
I'm next?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a really high variance pick because I think, as Galen Pick just showed, we're sort of past the point of
wow,
believability.
Howard Schultz, huh?
Yeah, Howard Schultz. No.
Wait, I'm sorry, what was that?
He's kind of disappeared, hasn't he? Howard Schultz? Is he still running?
Yeah.
He was never running. He was always exploring.
Yeah. I'm going to pick Michelle Obama.
Absolutely terrible pick because she'll never.
We can't do this live because people just pick that they think the audience will respond.
No, that's, no. Wait a second. We are at a point now where for someone in this round to win, something bonkers would have to happen. Now, if something bonkers happened and it results in Mitch Landrieu winning, but. Something, if this primary turns into an absolute shit show and you need a white knight to come in, Michelle Obama is perfect. She comes in, rescues the party, becomes the nominee, and makes me look good in a year.
Oh, I have a pick if we're going another. Okay.
All right. No, we got to wrap things up. And Claire, you're going to close this out for us.
I guess I'm not going to do a high variance pick. I'm going to do John Hickenlooper.
Boo. At least Miss Landrieu didn't get booed.
I didn't think people had any feelings about John Hickenlooper.
Even that's progress, actually.
I think given how far down this is, the fact that he is a centrist governor of a purple state is helpful.
That's
and I think he's a solid pick, whoever that was.
All right, let's wrap things up. But now that we're at the end, audience, it is up to you. We're going to go down the line, and you get to applaud for the drafts in aggregate. So let's start with Claire had Biden, Booker, Inslee, and Hickenlooper. Who thinks Claire wins it? All right.
I definitely win.
Micah has Harris, Klobuchar, Castro, and Michelle Obama.
Bad pick.
Michelle Obama was such a good pick.
All right. I had Warren, Beto, Abrams, and Landrieu. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. And Nate had Sanders, Buttigieg, Yang, and Gillibrand. Pretty sure I won that one.
That's the first time Nate ever, I think, outright lost the draft.
I don't think it's terrible.
I think my draft's good.
I think your teams are actually really bad. You guys have, like, people who just are never going to run.
It's like inverse. It's like an inverse order of how much pander.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right? Yeah, Nate.
Yeah.
All right. Whatever you have to tell yourself.
Yeah, really.
That is a wrap for this installment of the 538 Democratic primary draft. And with that, let's say goodbye. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. A special thanks to Vanessa Diaz, our manager of business operations, who organized tonight's show. Thank you, Vanessa. Round of applause for Vanessa. Thank you as well to Stephanie Roos, Tony Chow, and everyone at Houston's Hobby Center. Thank you, thank you. And again, thank you to Erica Greeter for joining us this evening for that conversation. Really appreciate it. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review, or just tell someone about the show. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.